Reset Movement is attempting to write the final chapter of a story that began more than a century ago, not in 2020, as so many believe. The Great Reset is nothing more than a perfected version of System X. Like Chase's framework, the Great Reset depends on a powerful, centralized government led by large executive branch government bureaucracies. Similarly, the reset depends on the control of banking, credit, and security exchanges. It also involves a huge social program like those dreamt up by Chase, the Green New Deal and the European Green Deal. They were even named after Chase and FDR's New Deal reforms. The Great Reset also requires the use of managed currencies. Without such a system, modern monetary theory, the fuel of the Great Reset machine, would be impossible. Further, the Great Reset depends on control of agricultural production, transportation, and energy sources, all right in line with Chase's description of System X. Heavy taxation is another shared component of System X and the Great Reset, as is System X government control without ownership, the primary purpose of environmental, social, and governance metrics. With all of this in mind, it is clear that System X is the Great Reset, and the Great Reset is System X. Understanding that the Great Reset is part of a much larger narrative is vital for many reasons, but perhaps the most important is that it reveals how close we are to seeing our national sovereignty, right to self-determination, and protections for individual liberty slip away. Within the larger historical context, the movement for individual liberty is hanging on by a thread. We have been fighting this battle for more than a century, and now we are seemingly one breath away from catastrophe. For those of you who still think that President Biden and America's other leaders in the Democratic and Republican parties are working for you, and that they would never let Great Reset elites transform the United States so they have even greater power over Main Street America, the remainder of this chapter is going to be a very rough wake-up call. President Biden might present himself as a Scranton-born, corn-pop-fighting, lunch-pail-carrying champion of blue-collar America. But he and numerous members of his administration, as well as many of Biden's closest political allies outside of the White House, are as devoted to the globalist, corporatist principles of the Great Reset as anyone working at the World Economic Forum has ever been. And numerous members of Congress and key social and political leaders are right there with him. Their mission is to finish the implementation of System X under the Great Reset banner. And they will not stop until they succeeded where so many others before them have fallen short. Countless members of the press have argued that this is just a wild conspiracy theory cooked up by the far right to scare you. Why should you believe Glenn Beck when the New York Times is portraying the Great Reset in a completely different light? Well, here's something you won't hear in the New York Times. They'll never say this, especially when it comes to the Great Reset. Do not take my word for it. Do your own homework. Buy this book and look at all of the footnotes. Only read it from the original source, the people at the World Economic Forum and in our own government. And you will see that the Great Reset is all too real and an overt power grab by the ruling class, one that might be impossible to fully reverse once it is in place. We have no time. And the people who are saying, I think that's ridiculous, if they don't follow that up with true homework, with original sources, they are part of the problem. The remainder of this chapter will present you with incontrovertible evidence, most of which comes from politically unbiased or left-leaning sources, and it proves beyond any doubt that Joe Biden and other influential U.S. political leaders are working feverishly to impose the Great Reset. These evidences are not the only proof out there, but they are a good place to start. If you keep an open mind and use the original source I provide throughout this chapter and allow yourself to view the data objectively, I am confident you will see why I am so convinced that the Great Reset is on the verge of becoming a reality in America. The evidence. Exhibit A, Al Gore and elites, climate change solutions. As I noted in Chapter 1, Al Gore, the self-proclaimed savior of the world, called for the Great Reset in a June 2020 interview with NBC's Today television show, during which he tied a huge green infrastructure plan to the coronavirus recovery. So, I think this is a time for a Great Reset, Gore said, after arguing in favor of electric cars and renewable energy sources like wind and solar. Quote, we've got to fix a lot of these problems that have been allowed to fester for way too long. And the climate crisis is an opportunity to create tens of millions of new jobs, clean up the air, reduce the death rate from pandemics, by the way, air pollution from burning fossil fuels heightens the death rates from coronavirus. 414. Gore, a close political ally of Joe Biden, has not only supported the reset on television, he is also a member of the World Economic Forum's Board of Trustees, 415. Gore's well-funded climate reality project has also worked closely with the WEF's Global Shapers Youth Activist Organization over the past several years. The Climate Reality Project has trained now more than 1,300 global shapers on the best practices for engaging in climate and environmental activism. Gore's involvement with the Global Shapers is extremely important, since the WEF announced it in June 2020 that these youth activists will play a vital role at the future Great Reset meetings. According to the WEF, there are now Global Shaper groups in 400 cities, and it's not hard to imagine how these groups could be used to promote the Great Reset agenda in 2021 and beyond under the guise of an urgent need to solve the climate change crisis. The blueprint for using youth engagement to support climate alarmism and socialist policies is already well established. Al Gore and other alarmists successfully piggybacked on the fame of Greta Thunberg to organize and promote massive rallies and climate strikes in 2019. In that year alone, millions of students participated in climate strikes around the world, 419. The Global Shapers and Climate Reality Project have extensive climate activist infrastructure that will allow them to quickly organize hundreds of thousands or even millions of people in support of the Great Reset. In November 2019, the Climate Reality Project hosted more than 2,000 presentations in 84 countries and 50 U.S. states, reaching more than 119,000 people as part of its 24 Hours of Reality worldwide event. Gore and other climate activists, including groups like Greenpeace International, are deeply tied to the Great Reset. But it is not because the reset is the only or even best way to reduce carbon dioxide levels. As I discussed in Chapter 3, even if you believe a climate crisis is happening as a result of human-created CO2 emissions, nuclear power and other forms of energy production now in development clearly offer a more realistic and environmentally friendly path towards phasing out the use of fossil fuels. The only reason elites like Gore so desperately want to expand the use of wind and solar power is because it would demand huge new public works projects, massive amounts of government funding, and an expansion of power for large corporations and financial institutions, all of which are strategies the ruling class has been using for more than a century to transform society, going back decades before anyone ever heard of global warming. Exhibit B. Al Gore is not the only prominent member of the ruling class or ally of Joe Biden to support the Great Reset. In addition to the long list of U.S. business leaders who have already stated publicly that they support the Great Reset, 422, there is John Kerry, the Democrats' 2004 presidential nominee, the former Secretary of State during Barack Obama's second term, and one of the least inspiring speakers on the face of the planet. In June 2020, in an interview with the World Economic Forum, Kerry confessed his love for the reset and demanded a new social contract that could address climate change and inequity. a key talking point of WAF's Great Reset campaign. All of the forces and pressures that were pushing us into crisis over the social contract are now exacerbated, Kerry said, and exacerbated at a time when the world is, in many ways, coming apart. What we never did, Kerry added, was adequately address the social contract, the franchisement of human beings around the world, to be able to participate in things that they can see with their smartphones everywhere but can't participate in. Kerry then argued that the United States is too politically gridlocked, so it's going to have to be up to the World Economic Forum and its allies to promote the reset on a global scale. This is the big moment, Kerry said, according to the WEF. The World Economic Forum, the CEO capacity of the forum, is really going to have to play a front and center role in refining the Great Reset to deal with climate change and inequity, all of which is being laid bare as a consequence of COVID-19. Kerry mostly disappeared from the public spotlight after Donald Trump defeated Hillary Clinton in the year 2016 in the presidential race. But beginning in 2020, Kerry managed to take on an increasingly important role within the Democratic Party. In 2020, Kerry was named by Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders to co-chair one of their unity task forces, which were given the responsibility of rewriting the platforms of the Democratic Party and Biden's presidential campaign. Kerry served as a co-chair of the Climate Change Task Force alongside with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, just as the Great Reset movement was starting to gain steam. As I mentioned earlier, Kerry is a very close political ally of Biden, who Kerry endorsed early in the 2020 race. In November 2020, as a reward for his loyalty, Biden named Kerry America's newest climate envoy for national security, a cabinet-level position the media often refers to as the climate czar. It should come as no surprise, then, that some of the Great Reset's policy proposals and talking points managed to find their way into Biden's 2020 campaign platform. I will show you in detail in Exhibit C next. Exhibit C, Joe Biden's Build Back Better plan and its ties to the Great Reset. Biden's Build Back Better plan, by the way, great name, Joe, is full of the World Economic Forum's policy ideas. For example, Biden's Climate and Energy Build Back Better plan aimed to make a $2 trillion accelerated investment with a plan to deploy those resources over his first term, setting us on an irreversible course to meet the ambitious climate progress that science demands by moving, quoting, ambitiously to generate clean American-made electricity to achieve a carbon pollution-free power sector by 2035, end quote. Now, according to Biden's website, the transition to green energy sources like wind and solar is necessary to stop the existential threat of climate change. Transforming the U.S. electricity sector, quoting, and electrifying an increasing share of the economy represents the biggest job creation and economic opportunity engine of the 21st century. Biden's campaign website claims these jobs include every kind of worker, from scientists to construction workers, to electricity generation workers, to welders and engineers. Existing iron casting and steel fabrication plants will have new customers in the solar and wind industries. These and many other parts of Biden's Build Back Better campaign proposals would later become core pieces in President Biden's infrastructure legislation proposed in early 2021. All of this talk about massive climate infrastructure plans sure does sound familiar, doesn't it? I mean, Klaus Schwab should be so proud. Biden's connection to the Great Reset policies was made even clearer at a July 2020 campaign event in Pennsylvania, during which Biden pitched his $700 billion jobs plan while calling for the end of the era of shareholder capitalism. That is, as you know by now, a common reset talking point. Let's make sure workers have power and voice. It's way past time to put an end to the era of shareholder capitalism. The idea that the only responsibility a corporation has is to its shareholders. That's simply not true. It's an absolute farce. They have a responsibility to their workers, to their country. That isn't new or radical notion. It is almost as though Biden were reading directly from the Great Reset press release written by Schwab himself. In reality, forcing companies to put the collective before their customers and owners is absolutely a radical idea in a free society. But Joe is right, it's hardly new. The Great Reset supporters have been loudly calling for the end of shareholder capitalism for a very long time, in some cases for years, as I showed you in detail in Chapter 5. Additionally, the very name Biden uses for some of his campaign's largest jobs and energy plans, Build Back Better, is the exact title used for similar proposals and articles written by supporters or allies of the World Economic Forum and the Great Reset movement, with some of those writings going back several years. In 2015, Raja Rahan Arshad, the lead disaster risk management specialist for Global Facility for Disaster Reduction and Recovery, authored an article for the World Economic Forum in which he wrote that following natural disasters, policymakers should restore damaged houses, hospitals, schools, and other public infrastructure to more disaster-resilient standards, a plan that, quoting, is one aspect of the Building Back Better strategy, end quote. In 2016, the World Bank and World Economic Forum published an article about climate change disasters titled, How Can We Reduce the Risk of Climate Disasters? In the article, the author wrote, the pressure for governments now is not to wait until disaster strikes, but to build back better. Instead, the urgent need is to build back better now and thoroughly assess current risks to industrial infrastructure, end quote. Following the emergence of the coronavirus pandemic in 2020, WEF writers published a flurry of articles citing Build Back Better or some variation of that slogan, prior to and after Biden's decision to ramp up the marketing of his Build Back Better plan as a key component of his 2020 campaign. In March 2020, two marketing heads at WEF wrote, business leaders have pledged to contribute their skills, networks, and resources to help shape the COVID-19 recovery and Build Back Better. The statement was made in an article published on WEF's website under the subheading, Companies Commit to Realizing a Great Reset of Capitalism. In April 2020, Maria Mendelus, the interim CEO of the We Mean Business Coalition, wrote for the World Economic Forum, as governments develop longer-term economic stimulus packages to combat the crisis, they must be designed around the core principle of building a stronger economy that ensures the long-term health and well-being of citizens, job creation, tackling climate change once and for all, and building a more resilient and inclusive society, end quote. She then wrote, quote, business and government can and must work together at this extremely challenging time to lay the foundations to build back better. Concrete government policies that send a clear signal to business will help us rebuild from this devastating crisis in a way that delivers a healthy future for everyone, through greater resilience and a clear pathway to zero carbon future. Does any of this start to make sense where you're looking now at what we're not doing, the lessons we don't seem to learn from for COVID, why we're not on the road to recovery yet, and why the president continues to talk about, I've got to pass my Build Back Better bill? In May 2020, the World Economic Forum posted a piece titled Building Back Better. Here's how we can navigate the risks we face after COVID-19. In the article, writer Johnny Wood noted, we have looked at ways to build back better, and it's very clear that investing in greener economies is going to be a huge part of recovery efforts. In June 2020, David Victor, chairman of the Global Agenda Council on Government for Sustainability at the World Economic Forum, if there ever was a quintessential Orwellian job title, I think that would be it, wrote an article for Yale's Environment 360 website titled Building Back Better, Why Europe Must Lead a Global Green Recovery. On July 13, 2020, just several days after Biden said it was time to put an end to the era of shareholder capitalism while pitching his Build Back Better jobs plan in Pennsylvania, Peter Baker and John Elkington authored an article for the World Economic Forum titled, To Build Back Better, We must reinvent capitalism. Here's how. In the article, the authors wrote, a true recovery, quoting, from COVID-19 will not be about putting things back together the way they were. We need to build back better, to reset, if we're going to address the deep systemic vulnerabilities the pandemic has exposed. For business, building back better is about much more than corporate social responsibility. It's about truly aligning markets with the natural, social, and economic systems on which they depend. It's all about real resilience, driving equitable and sustainable growth, and reinventing capitalism itself. Sorry, but this is hair-raising, isn't it? Having read the article cited here, along with numerous others using very similar language, it is hard to imagine that Joe Biden or whoever else was really calling the shots in the Biden campaign was not deliberately aligning his talking points and policy proposals with the Great Reset movement, especially in light of Al Gore and John Kerry's clear-cut endorsements of the Great Reset and their connection to Joe Biden. Exhibit D, Joe Biden's cozy relationships with Great Reset leaders. The evidence doesn't stop at Biden's campaign. Biden also has close relationships with at least three World Economic Forum board members, Al Gore, David Rubenstein, and Lawrence Fink, the chairman and CEO of BlackRock. And one of Vice President Kamala Harris's longtime supporters is the CEO of Salesforce, Mark Benioff, another WEF board member. Further, my co-author of this book, Justin Haskins, reported exclusively for The Blaze in October 2020 that additional evidence of Biden's intimate relationship with Great Reset advocates can be found in the launch of the Biden Institute, which is based at the University of Delaware. In 2017, Haskins continued, when the Biden Institute first started, Biden said he wanted to model some of the new organization's activities after the World Economic Forum. And then he even met with WEF's leader and the world's biggest advocate of the Great Reset, Klaus Schwab, to help develop the plan for the future of the Institute, end quote. Joe Biden has apparently been taking advice from Schwab for years, so it really shouldn't surprise anyone that Biden has also been drinking from Klaus's Great Reset Kool-Aid bucket. Speaking of which, if Schwab ever decides to give up this whole evil genius, take over the world career path he's been on for the past half century, start a knockoff Kool-Aid brand, called it Klaus-Aid. Ought to be a priority number one, I think. The commercials showing Klaus busting through kids' walls to give them sugary drinks and teach them about the evils of free markets would practically right themselves. Exhibit E, John Kerry's honest moment. If all the evidence is still not enough to convince you of Biden's commitment to the Great Reset, then, and it should be, I mean, really, honestly, what's wrong with you at this point? Consider the following smoking gun, the proof that emerged just weeks after the mainstream press declared Biden the winner of the 2020 election. At a panel discussion about the Great Reset, hosted by the World Economic Forum in November 2020, John Kerry adamantly stated that Joe Biden and his administration will support the Great Reset. He said, and I quote, and it will be with greater speed and with greater intensity than a lot of people might imagine, end quote, 447. During the panel discussion, host Borge Brende, WEF's president, asked Kerry whether the World Economic Forum's members and other Great Reset supporters are expecting, quoting, too much too soon from the new president, or is he going to deliver first day on these topics? To which Kerry responded, the answer to your question is no. You are not expecting too much, end quote. Then he added, quote, and yes, it, the Great Reset, will happen. And it will happen with greater speed and greater intensity than a lot of people might imagine. In effect, the citizens of the United States have just done a Great Reset. We've done a Great Reset, and it was a record level of voting. End quote. It doesn't get much clearer than that. But let me give you Exhibit F, Joe Biden's Mao agency. Kerry's promise of a Biden-led American Great Reset was not merely talk, either. Since President Biden has entered the White House, he and his administration have imposed countless policies and proposed numerous more that fit perfectly in line with the Great Reset's goals, framework, and principles. For example, consider Biden's new Made in America office, or as I like to call it, his MAO agency. I mean, sometimes they just make it too easy. On the surface, the Made in America agency sounds like something that might have been created by the Trump administration, other than the agency's acronym. I mean, maybe it's just maybe it's something tells me Donald Trump wouldn't want a supposedly pro-America bureaucratic agency named after a mass-murdering communist dictator. But the stated purpose of MAO is to require that government offices spend more of their budgets working with American companies as opposed to purchasing goods and services from businesses located overseas. This sounds like a noble goal. I mean, sounds like something I could get behind, right? Yes, except as always, the devil is in the details, 450. When the White House announced the creation of MAO, it noted that the agency would not direct government agencies to do business with just any old U.S. company that offers the best product or service at the lowest price. Rather, MAO would be used as a tool to advance the Biden administration's political and social agendas. According to the White House, the order creating MAO is, quote, deeply intertwined with the president's commitment to invest in American manufacturing, including clean energy and critical supply chains, growing good-paying union jobs that advance racial equity. The federal government should buy from suppliers that are growing the sectors of the future and treating their workers with dignity and respect. End quote, 451. In other words, the MAO agency's mission is to make sure that the federal government buys only from the good companies, meaning those businesses that reflect the values of the Biden administration. This is unquestionably a Great Reset policy proposed by the World Economic Forum's Klaus Schwab, as well as other supporters of the reset. As I noted earlier in the book, Schwab's article titled Now is the Time for a Great Reset, published in June 2020, he wrote this. The second component of a Great Reset agenda would ensure that investments advance shared goals such as equality and sustainability, rather than using these funds, as well as investments from private entities and pension funds, to fill cracks in the old system. We should use them to create a new one that is more resilient, equitable, and sustainable in the long run. This means, for example, building green urban infrastructure and creating incentives for industries to improve their track record on environmental, social, and governance metrics. Biden's MAO agency is designed to do exactly what Schwab said is a core component of the Great Reset. Ensure that government funds are funneled into the businesses committed to making the social and political changes desired by elites. Exhibit G, Biden's 30 by 30 land and water plan. One of his first acts as president, Joe Biden released an executive order calling on government to conserve about 30% of all U.S. lands and water by 2030. It's a program referred to as 30 by 30. According to the Washington Post, as of May 2021, roughly 12% of U.S. land and 11% of its freshwater ecosystems enjoy some level of official protection. That means if Biden is successful in ensuring that 30% of all U.S. lands and waters are conserved by 2030, it would more than double the amount of land conserved in the United States, making this program one of the largest government takeovers in U.S. history. Moving many forms of property ownership, not just land ownership, away from private individuals and farmers and into the hands of government and large corporations is viewed by many within the Great Reset movement as an imperative. In the minds of many resetters, lands under public or corporate ownership can more easily be conserved and or utilized for the public good. Government laws can be crafted to slow or stop land use And corporations can be discouraged or severely hindered from developing land through the ESG systems. Many ESG scoring systems already include metrics for land use and consumption of resources. It is not enough, according to many involved with the World Economic Forum and the Great Reset, to limit environmental harm. We must also enhance ecosystems by severely restricting and even reducing humans' existing land use. In an article, What is Nature Positive and Why is it the Key to Our Future?, published by the World Economic Forum in June 2021, high-profile environmentalists and members of the World Economic Forum outline their vision for a nature-positive approach to policymaking and corporate management. In the past, the mantra among a growing number of inspired leaders, they wrote, has been to do less harm, to reduce impact, to tread lightly across our world. Of course, this mantra remains, but now there is a new worldview gathering pace, nature-positive. This asks, what if we go beyond damage limitation? What if our economic activities not only minimize impact, but also enhance ecosystems? Nature positive is a disruptive idea. It forces us to think differently about our place in the world. It's a destination for humanity. It's the foundation for good governance, long-term stable societies, and healthy economies. It's a philosophy that values our common future. And it's a new business model based on regeneration, resilience, recirculation, not destruction and pollution. What exactly do these great resetters have in mind when they talk about enhancing ecosystems? This means, quoting, governments, cities, and businesses need to know what to measure. Science-based targets for a nature-positive trajectory are still under intense discussion. As of today, proposed quantitative targets are as follows. Zero loss of nature from 2020 onwards. Nature positive by 2030. And full recovery by 2050. An important step towards this is to aim to protect 30% of the land and the ocean by 2030. Wait. Conserving 30% of the land and the oceans by 2030. You mean like a 30 by 30 plan? Oh, didn't I just read something about that somewhere? This movement within the Great Reset to limit property ownership, to centralize control of property, might also explain why Reset-affiliated investment firms are buying up as much property as they can get their hands on. Fox News reported in June 2021, citing additional reporting by the Wall Street Journal, that BlackRock, led by billionaire Lawrence Fink, is purchasing entire neighborhoods and converting single-family homes into rentals. While in cities like Houston, investors like Fink account for 1/4 of the home purchases. BlackRock is one of the world's most powerful investment management companies. And as I have mentioned earlier in this chapter and in Chapter 5, its billionaire leader, Lawrence Fink, is an ally of Joe Biden and serves as a member of the World Economic Forum's board of directors. Other Great Reset-linked businesses and financial institutions have also taken part in the buying spree, including J.P. Morgan Chase. Although not all people affiliated with the World Economic Forum believe the results of this shift would be wholly positive, many do think it's an unavoidable part of elites' new economy and that the reduction of private ownership would be mostly a good development. Danish Member of Parliament Ida Auken was asked by the World Economic Forum to provide a prediction for 2030, to which Auken responded with an article titled, Welcome to 2030. I own nothing. I have no privacy. And life has never been better. In the article, Auken wrote that in her version of 2030, quote, I don't own anything. I don't own a car. I don't own a house. I don't own any appliances or any clothes. It might seem odd to you, but it makes perfect sense for us in this city in 2030. Everything you considered a product has now become just a service. We have access to transportation, accommodation, food, and all the things we need in our daily lives. One by one, all these things became free. So it just ended up not making sense for us to own much. Once in a while, I do get annoyed about the fact that I have no real privacy in 2030. Nowhere I can go and not be registered. I know that somewhere, everything I do, think, and dream of is recorded. I just hope nobody will use it against me. But all in all, life is good. Much better than the path we were on, where it became so clear that we just could not continue with the same model of growth. We had all these terrible things happening. Lifestyle diseases, climate change, the refugee crisis, environmental degradation, completely congested cities, water pollution, air pollution, social unrest, and unemployment. We lost way too many people before we realized that we could do things differently. 460. Well, we know that the folks at the World Economic Forum think an existence in which regular people own almost nothing and have no real privacy is, all in all, a good life. But is this the world you want to leave for your children and grandchildren? I know it's not the one I want to leave for mine, and I am willing to bet many who are reading this book and need to read this book will agree. Exhibit H, Biden kills Trump's fair access rule. In President Trump's final days in office, his administration released what would have been an incredibly important regulation, one that had the potential to stop some of the most dangerous parts of the Great Reset in its tracks. Trump's fair access rule would have made it difficult, and in many cases impossible, for banks to discriminate against legal businesses on the basis of the type of industry that they're in, thus forcing banking institutions to focus solely on financial matters. According to the rule, banks should conduct risk assessment of individual customers rather than make broad-based decisions affecting whole categories or classes of customers when positioning access to services, capital, and credit. In practice, the rule would have made it difficult for a bank to, for example, deny a gun store owner access to a loan solely because the bank's leaders didn't think legal gun ownership was a good idea for America. In the same way, a bank would not have been permitted to deny an oil company a loan because of concerns over CO2 emissions. Although the rule had been approved by the Trump administration's Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, it had not gone into effect when Biden entered the White House. So the Biden administration just killed that regulation before it could be fully implemented. If Trump's fair access rule had been imposed, it is unlikely the Great Reset would be gaining so much ground so quickly today within much of the banking industry, because one of the most powerful devices in the Great Reset toolbox is the use of ESG scores and other similar metrics by banks to determine access to credit. It would have been unavailable. Biden knew how vital the fair access rule would have been in slowing the Great Reset, so unsurprisingly, he crushed it before it could take effect. Exhibit I, Congress flirts with ESG. Now, nothing would advance the Great Reset agenda more than a new law that mandates ESG standards and reporting. In June 2021, Congress moved a step closer to imposing far-reaching ESG rules with the passage of the ESG Disclosure Simplification Act of 2021 in the U.S. House of Representatives. According to a report by the National Law Review, the bill, which still has not been reviewed by the Senate as of this writing, September 2021, would require the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, for the very first time, to define in regulations ESG metrics for the purpose of guiding required corporate disclosures under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 and the Act of 1933 as amended. The National Law Review further noted that if the bill were to pass into law, then in consent solicitation or proxy statements, issuers would be required to include A, a clear description of the views of the issuer about the link between ESG metrics and the long-term business strategy of the issuer, B, a description of any process the issuer uses to determine the impact of ESG metrics on the long-term business strategy of the issuer. End quote. The legislation would also establish a sustainable finance advisory committee, which would be required to submit to the SEC within 180 days after initial meetings, a report with recommendations on what ESG metric issuers should be required to disclose. The language of the bill states that the Sustainable Finance Advisory Committee's report would need to, one, identify the challenge and opportunities for investors associated with sustainable finance, and two, recommend policy changes to facilitate the flow of capital towards sustainable investments, in particular environmentally sustainable investments, end quote. The ESG Disclosure Simplification Act would also allow the SEC to incorporate any internationally recognized, independent, multi-stakeholder environmental, social, and governance disclosure standards, including any standards created by the European Union, World Economic Forum, or United Nations, 466. Although the bill is not likely to pass in the U.S. Senate with the current composition of Congress, its passage in the House and its support, the support it received from the Biden administration, should serve as a slap in the face to any doubters who think ESG mandates are not a priority for many in Washington. A wide-ranging ESG system on the verge of becoming law in the United States, even though most Americans still have absolutely no idea what ESG metrics are. Exhibit J calls for a credit score takeover. In addition to attempting to pass sweeping ESG mandates, many members of Congress and nonprofit advocacy groups have called for the federal government to take over individual credit scoring and move some prominent activists already suggesting could be used to help Congress and federal bureaucracies reshape society. Think of this as a government-provided personal ESG score. At the time of this writing, personal credit scores are developed by three non-government credit bureaus, Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian, each of which creates a unique FICO score for individuals. Credit scores are based entirely on financial information that helps banks and other institutions determine how much risk is associated with various financial arrangements made with a potential customer or lendee. The popular finance economics website, The Balance, notes, traditionally, the FICO score is the most popular score used for important loans like home and auto loans. No matter what score you use, most models are looking for a way to predict how likely you are to pay your bills on time, end quote. The Balance further explains, the FICO credit score looks at how much debt you have, how you've repaid in the past, and more. Scores range from 300 and 850, and they're made up of the following components. Credit mix, 10%. Payment history, 35%. Current debt, 30%. Length of credit history, 15%. And new credit, 10%. Now, many members of Congress and supporters of the Great Reset want to alter the existing credit score system so it can be used to redistribute wealth and power. One of the most popular proposals involves creating a government-run credit agency, the Public Credit Registry. This would be responsible for issuing fair credit scores to consumers. It would be housed under the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the brainchild of Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts. Many of those in Congress advocating for putting government in charge of individual credit scores have said the existing credit scoring agencies are too dysfunctional to be trusted, and that government agencies would be much more effective and fairer in their approach. Because, you know, when you're faced with a large, irresponsive, inefficient bureaucratic system, the first group of people you turn to in order to fix the problem is the federal government, right? Others, however, have been a little more honest about their motives. At a hearing about the possibility of overhauling the existing credit system held in June 2021 by the U.S. House Committee on Financial Services, Representative Maxine Waters, the chair of the committee, said the current model needs to be deconstructed because for far too long, quoting, our credit reporting system has kept people of color and low-income persons from access to capital to start small businesses, access to mortgage loans to become homeowners, and access to credit to meet financial emergencies, end quote. As her statement makes it clear, in Waters' view, credit scoring reforms should center on social justice, not merely financial concerns. At the same hearing, Qiqi Wu, an attorney at the National Consumer Law Center, advocated for the passage of legislation creating a federal credit scoring agency, and she specifically noted that one of the benefits would be that the new agency would give novel tools to government to fix social and economic problems. Quote, while public agencies are not perfect, at least they would not have profit-making as their top priority, Wu said at the hearing. They would be responsive to public pressure and government oversight. They would also be charged with developing credit scoring models to reduce the yawning racial and economic inequality in this country. Reducing the yawning racial and economic inequality. Wow, that makes for a great soundbite on CNN. But the ramifications of putting the federal government in charge of credit scoring decisions would be far-reaching, deeply troubling, especially if the agency tasked with creating and managing scores is empowered with the authority to fix society's ills. A public credit registry could, for example, ensure that some races get lower interest car loans than more privileged races. Asians and whites already have enough cars. PCR bureaucrats could reason, so let's make sure other racial groups get the best rates. Similarly, a public credit registry could effectively deny access to loans for some successful business owners. After all, they already have enough wealth, don't they? Let's give other people a chance. Oh, and you want a mortgage for your new home that you've been saving up for a decade? Sorry, we already have enough homeowners of your race in your zip code. We need a greater racial equity. So you're going to have to get by with the rock bottom credit score and sky high mortgage rates. These hypotheticals might sound extreme, but what else could Qiqi possibly had in mind when she said a government credit agency could develop credit scoring models to reduce the yawning racial and economic inequality in this country? The current credit scoring industry could be improved, no doubt about that. But putting a politically motivated government bureaucracy in charge of credit scoring would create far more problems than it would solve. Unless, of course, you want a total reset of the current economic system and social contract. If that's your goal, then Qiqi's call for government credit score makes a whole lot of sense. Exhibit K, building back better at the G7. In most years, watching meetings of the G7, a group of world leaders hailing from Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, United Kingdom, and the United States, is about as interesting as watching half-blurred reruns of Traffic Court on public access television. But the 2021 meeting of the G7, the first such meeting featuring President Biden, caught my attention when Biden announced he and his G7 pals had agreed to launch a global infrastructure development plan that seemed nearly identical to numerous proposals I had previously talked about and heard ooze out of the mouth of Klaus Schwab and other Great Reset advocates. Biden called the initiative a Build Back Better World. According to this statement by the White House, quote, through B3W, Build Back Better World, the G7 and other like-minded partners will coordinate in mobilizing private sector capital in four areas of focus: climate, health and health security, digital technology, and gender equity and equality, with catalytic investments from our respective development finance institutions. What? Those areas of focus do sound eerily familiar. I mean, they sound just like the goals set forth by just about every single Great Reset document ever published. This is the Build Back Better World Plan. Mm-hmm. This is the one the White House estimates will lead to hundreds of billions of dollars of infrastructure investment. It would not simply provide run-of-the-mill investments in roads and bridges. No, no, no. The White House says the investment will be values-driven, and carried out in a transparent and sustainable manner, financially, environmentally, and socially, end quote, 474. They also, of course, will be focused on battling climate change, and achieving the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement, end quote. ESG and the banking regulations, anyone? I could write a few more paragraphs further outlining how the Build Back Better world plan is overtly connected to the Great Reset goals, but if you cannot see that by now, you're never going to. You haven't been paying attention, or you just refuse to see it. Could the Great Reset actually happen here in America? Well, toward the end of my detailed look at the Great Reset in Chapter 5, I included a modified version of a question I hear all the time from listeners and readers. Can the Great Reset really happen in America of all places? You know, that's an important question. The United States is not China or Europe, at least not yet. So just because there are some very troubling developments occurring on the other side of the world does not necessarily mean Americans are going to be forced to deal with the same problems. Despite all of our issues and near fundamental transformation of American society that has occurred in recent years, the United States has not totally lost its soul yet. If it had, honestly, I wouldn't have bothered writing this book. But when you add up all the evidence that I've outlined through this chapter and in Chapter 5, Biden's policy platforms and the statements, Biden's Build Back Better slogan, the massive ESG infrastructure that has already been put into place in America's banks and large corporations, attempts to have the government take over America's credit scoring system, the commitments made by more than 200 major financial institutions around the world to support those ESG systems, calls in Congress for ESG mandates, and more than $100 trillion in support from investors associated with the Principles for Responsible Investment, the G7's Build Back Better World Plan, and quotes promoting the reset by powerful figures like Al Gore, John Kerry, and the leaders of a seemingly endless list of activist groups, international organizations, and billion-dollar corporations in the United States, it's really hard for me to see how any reasonable person could deny that the Great Reset has already gained a significant amount of momentum in America. The most important question that we have to ask ourselves, then, is not whether the Great Reset is possible or even desired by many in the ruling class, nor is it whether the Great Reset would be harmful to markets or individual liberty. The answer to those questions, I think, are already determined, as this chapter and my other chapters have already proven. Rather, the essential question is one that defines the next century of American history, and it is this: what can be done to stop it? That vital question is the subject of this book's next and final chapter. Chapter 7, Derailing the Great Reset. The truth of the matter is that you always know the right thing to do. The hard part is doing it. General Norman Schwarzkopf. By all accounts, there was nothing special about the train that left Zurich for Germany on April 9, 1917. As with the dozens of other train rides that occurred in the region, the machine's loud, powerful engine bellowed across Switzerland's beautiful landscape, featuring rolling hills, picturesque farmhouses, and the stunning Rhine Falls, one of Europe's largest waterfalls, as the train moved ever closer to its destination farther north. For most bystanders, the speeding passenger train was likely a welcome departure to normalcy in an otherwise chaotic world. Although Switzerland in 1917 had managed to remain at peace, much of the rest of Europe was mired in a bloody Great War. By 1917, World War I had already taken the lives of millions of men, women, and children. On its own, Russia had suffered 5 million casualties. On all sides of the conflict, soldiers died by the most wretched of conditions, from chemical weapons or a bayonet to the chest in a frozen trench hundreds of miles from home. At the Battle of the Somme in France, more than 60,000 British soldiers died on the battle's first day alone. But there were a few soldiers on the Swiss train from Zurich, and just as few weapons of war. Many of its passengers were shabbily dressed and carried only the most basic of provisions, light clothing, blankets, books for the long journey ahead, paper and ink for writing, and limited food rations consisting of sausage, cheese, bread rolls, and hard-boiled eggs. The train, its destination, and its passengers appeared in almost every way to be normal. Yet there was nothing commonplace about this fateful trip. It was, in fact, in the most meaningful sense, extraordinary and world-changing. The fate of hundreds of millions of people would forever be altered by the work of its passengers, and millions of lives would be lost at the hands of the train's most profound and ruthless traveler, Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, a man better known today by his alias, Lenin. Lenin, then in his mid-40s, had spent the better part of the previous two decades in exile, eventually settling in Switzerland with radicals who had been forced out of Russia and other European nations for attempting to spark an international revolutionary socialist movement. While in Switzerland, Lenin had spent his days feverishly writing. In 1916, he authored Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, and started one of his most important books, State and Revolution, all while secretly working from across the continent to undermine the authority of the Russian Tsar, Nicholas II. So in March 1917, when Lenin, who had in recent months grown disheartened and convinced that the global Marxist revolution that he believed to be inevitable could be many, many years away, heard that Nicholas had abdicated the throne, he was nothing short of exhilarated. Tsar Nicholas had been forced from power following a spontaneous revolution of the Russian people and soldiers, who had become disenfranchised over Nicholas's handling of World War I and disturbed by rumors of the growing influence in Russia's royal court of the bizarre Siberian mystic Rasputin, 479. When word of the Tsar's removal reached Lenin, he and his fellow Marxists began to tirelessly work to find a way to return to Russia. The trip was, at that time, a monumental challenge because the nations surrounding Switzerland were still at war. In the weeks prior to Lenin's departure from Zurich, Lenin and some of his closest comrades became so desperate that they approached a most unlikely potential ally, Germany, hoping that a deal could be struck between the two parties. The German government was no friend of Lenin or his socialist compatriots, but German officials were eventually persuaded to broker a deal with him. They would allow Lenin and 31 other socialist revolutionaries to travel in April through Germany on their way to Russia, but only if they agreed to work toward ending Russia's involvement in the war once they arrived home. It was a remarkable and unexpected conspiracy, one that would reshape world history. With the help of anti-socialist German officials, Lenin returned to Russia a hero among those sympathetic to his Marxist views. Despite being a relatively small minority in Russia, the more radical Bolshevik socialists, led by Lenin, stormed the Winter Palace in Petrograd, now called St. Petersburg. On the night of October 25th, they seized power from the Russian Provisional Government. The Provisional Government was so weak and the skirmish so short that on the following morning, many citizens of Petrograd had no idea that the revolution had occurred or that an entirely new nation was about to be created. Soon thereafter, Lenin's socialists took control of the Kremlin in Moscow. A secret police force, the Cheka, and prison camps were then established, and rival newspapers and political parties were eliminated. The Bolsheviks renamed themselves communists, both to help with branding outside of Russia, where the term Bolshevik was not well known, and to differentiate Lenin's revolutionaries from other European socialists who had supported getting involved in World War I. Then they negotiated a treaty with Germany to buy time while they waged a civil war in Russia with counter-revolutionary White Army forces. World War I ended in 1918, but Russia's civil war would last until 1920, and the Socialist Red Army would continue fighting in Eastern Europe until 1921, in the hope of ushering in a worldwide Marxist revolution. On December 30th, 1922, Lenin Socialist funded the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, and over its 69-year history, tens of millions of Russians and Eastern Europeans would be murdered, slaughtered, or exiled, or unjustly imprisoned by its ruthless government, all in the name of equality. 480. Although by 1917, a revolution in Russia was likely inevitable, a Marxist socialist revolution most certainly was not. Had the German government refused to conspire with Lenin and allow him and his comrades to travel through Germany on their way to Russia, it is entirely possible the Bolsheviks' attempt to seize power would have been derailed, and perhaps today, Lenin would be nothing more than a footnote in history. Conspiracy theories. Lenin's historic train ride through Germany is important for a number of reasons, but perhaps the most overlooked is the proof that a well-timed conspiracy can bring about remarkable and dangerous change, even when such change seems highly improbable. Americans have often thought of the United States as too big to fail, and that fringe political groups seeking revolutionary changes to our society and constitution have little chance of success. I am sure that Tsar Nicholas II felt exactly the same way for much of his life, and I am willing to bet that most Russians at the start of 1917 did not believe that within just a few short years, a band of relatively poor, shabbily dressed political exiles from Switzerland would be ruling with an iron fist over one of the world's largest nations. But that is exactly what happened. Now, this doesn't mean that all or even most conspiracies should be taken seriously. In recent years, ridiculous conspiracy theories covering everything from fake moon landings to shape-shifting reptilians controlling our government have become popular among some groups. And although it is tempting to laugh away the sweaty rants by tinfoil hat-wearing fat guys lamenting the rise of lizard people, conspiracy theories that are not grounded in truth and the media's decision to engage in the rampant dissemination of false information to achieve political goals have become two of the biggest threats facing America today. Because people do not know who to trust, we now live in a world of alternative facts, where seemingly everything is fake. Fake news, fake outrage, fake accusations. Now they even sell turkeys made of tofu. Is nothing real anymore? As a result, Americans are deeply confused and incredibly skeptical of anything that does not fit into their pre-existing set of beliefs. Trust in the media is embarrassingly low. Only one-third of self-identified Republicans and less than half of independents say they trust the media. Even among Democrats, who have a long list of left-leaning publications and television networks to choose from, the trust in the media is only 66%. The world's massive social media infrastructure and online publisher model has also contributed to the conspiracy theory pandemic. Most publishers and many authors earn much of their money by getting clicks on articles they produce. So the more outrageous the article, the more likely it is that the publisher and author will have a big payday. How many hundreds of millions of dollars did the media earn by churning out literally thousands of Trump-Russia collusion stories, most of which ended up being based on completely false information and lies? It's probably impossible to calculate here, but I can say this for certain. They made a heck of a lot more money with the collusion narrative than they would have made without it. The truth doesn't matter. The money does. Conspiracy theories, dishonest media reports, the deep political and social divisions that have resulted from them could end up being the final nail in America's coffin. If we cannot even agree on whether the stories we see in the press are true, or even what the truth means, we cannot have honest conversations about complex issues like race, religion, foreign policy. So important, my next book is going to be artificial intelligence, or anything else that actually matters. The confusion and tribalism that has resulted from this culture of disregarding carefully cultivated truths in favor of outrage and clickbait have presented an unprecedented opportunity for supporters of the Great Reset, who use societal divisions and fear as a cover for their attempts to alter nearly every part of our country. Anyone, left or right, with the courage to stand up against them is labeled a conspiracy theorist and tossed aside as a lunatic. And because the mainstream press is so unwilling to expose the truth, tens of millions of Americans never hear well-documented, highly sourced facts that could shed a dramatic new light on nearly everything they see in the news on the daily basis. On radio, I've been saying that this book is a Rosetta Stone. There are so many questions that we're not asking, should be asked, or we don't believe the answer. It's because we don't know what's really going on behind the curtain. Now, hopefully, you see it. And this is a decoder ring or a Rosetta Stone. Once you understand what the Great Reset is, things change for you. You can even be a little more calm because you see how to dismantle it and you see what's coming. This is critical that you share this with your friends. Please, anyone who has an open mind or is willing to listen to logic, please share this book with them. Don't waste your time on